Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
In theory, nearly everybody would agree that kindness and compassion are worthy virtues. And nearly everyone would agree that kindness and compassion enhance the workplace. And yet, when I say the word workplace, do the words kindness and compassion jump to mind? In fact, it seems that ever fewer workplaces would be described as bastions of kindness and compassion, and that's true whether it be a for-profit, non-profit, or a government agency. The question is why? After all, the people who work in nonprofits or anywhere, run workplaces, they're the same people who claim that kindness and compassion are important. I find really fascinating that my guest this morning on Work with Marty Nemko, he writes about the importance of kindness and compassion in the workplace, and yet he admitted to me, and this is a quote, "I'm terrible at those nice things," end quote. And dear listeners, I must admit that I, too, am not often the king of compassion and kindness. Sometimes, but not always. So, topic one this morning on Work with Marty Nemko is, why don't we walk the talk? Is that because kindness and compassion are desirable but not worth the effort? Are other values more important than kindness and compassion? Is it simply that we humans are flawed? We aspire to ideals, but we don't necessarily achieve them. With me to kick this around, hopefully with a measure of kindness and compassion, and maybe he'll make us a little kinder and more compassionate. Or maybe he'll help us realize that it is sometimes wiser to be a no-nonsense, bottom-line meritocrat, is UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center's web editor, Jeremy Adam Smith. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Great to be here.
Good. Okay. So, Jeremy, why do you think we're such hypocrites?
Well, I wouldn't say that we're hypocrites. What I would say is that we are exquisitely social creatures who are very, very responsive to social cues and to our social environment. And I would say that there are two factors, especially in workplaces, that shape the degree to which we can be kind and compassionate and nice to each other. One is stress, and the other is inequality. Those two factors combined often make for very impolite, uncompassionate workplaces.
Well, I can certainly understand why, you know, if you're really stressed, it's hard to be compassionate and kind. How does inequality make one less likely to be compassionate and kind? You would think, you know, that's where we're constantly brainwashed. Be compassionate to the less fortunate. We're only as good as the least among us. I mean, America is built on a Christian heritage of the New Testament. And if there's anything that is core to the New Testament, it is be kind to the least among us. Why wouldn't inequality further compassion and kindness?
Because we have a deep evolutionary hardwiring to abuse power. It's very interesting. There's a lot of research, a lot of it done by my colleague Dacher Keltner at the Greater Good Science Center, about what power inequalities do to our brains. And what it does is it makes us much more impulsive. It makes us much less empathic with other human beings. It makes us much less compassionate. And which is not to say that, you know, if you have power, if you make a lot of money, you're intrinsically an unkind, uncompassionate person. What it means is that you have to work just a little bit harder to cultivate those qualities.
Couldn't the opposite actually be true? If I am dealing with somebody who is, say, a developmentally disabled person, there is tremendous amount of inequality in what my genes and my environment gave me. There would not be a scintilla of desire to be competitive, aggressive, whatever. That is good. The imbalance there is going to increase I'm going to make me less stressed, less defensive. I'm going to be much more compassionate. But if I'm dealing with an intellectual peer, an economic peer, then I'm going to just try to go on the merits. I don't have to be kind and be kind to the least among us. I can simply argue on the merits. If I think the person is wrong, I can say so. If I think the person gets fired, I wouldn't have any guilt. Oh, my God, this person's going to be homeless. Isn't it possible that the absolute opposite is true?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what you mean by the absolute opposite. I mean, you mentioned peer relationships. Peer relationships are hard because they're not structured. You know, when there's a power inequality, it's obvious who should be polite, who should be, who should be obsequious. It's the person with less power, right? When you're dealing with a peer, with somebody who you feel to be your equal, anything goes. And those are the situations where I think basically you have to fall back on common human decency as much as possible.
You talked about inequality, and mm-hmm. the ultimate inequality is inequality of capability, inequality of skills, etc.
Yeah.
And that is even more substantive than the power of boss and
you're saying, Marty, that you feel a natural inclination to be kind when you see that there's an inequality of capability there. Well, I think that's true for a lot of people, and
right.
I think that's something that should give us a little bit of faith in humanity. However, I needn't point out that that's just not always the case. It sounds like you might be better on average than a lot of people, because in point of fact, people can be tremendously cruel to people who they think are not as smart as them, who have some sort of disability. That can excite tremendous cruelty.
It certainly occurs in among kids, the bullying and the exclusionary behavior girls bullying as well as boys bullying. But in the work, the data is unequivocal that America is the most generous nation in the world.
Yeah.
What does generosity mean? Generosity to nonprofits means giving money, putting your money where your mouth is.
Yeah.
We give more money per capita, and the rich.
And time.
And time. The rich give huge amounts of money.
Yeah.
Corporations give huge amounts of money. So America could be described as the land of compassion, and yet in the workplace, whether it be with peers, with supervisees, or managing up. I mean, ideally, you would think that a worker bee who is paid overtime for every hour past 40 would feel a measure of sympathy for the boss who doesn't get paid a dime more whether he or she works 80 hours or 20 hours.
Right.
And yet there is rampant passive-aggressive and more aggressive backstabbing, withholding of information, sabotage, unfair treatment of people. There seems to be more going on than that inequality is the cause or a cause.
Sure. Well, I think if you point only to inequality, you're oversimplifying, obviously. There's a lot of factors that shape a workplace. However, I wouldn't minimize it. Oftentimes, if you have a situation where the boss is sort of consistently a jerk, if you have a workplace that is not transparent, where people are just sort of working in their little holes and they don't see what else is going on, that limits their empathy. You don't always, the boss might be working 80 hours a week, but that person might not know that. They might not see what the other people in their unit are dealing with. And if they don't see it, then they can't appreciate it. And if they don't appreciate it, then they're not being connected to their coworkers. They don't feel like they're part of a team.
I found interesting that you describe if the boss is a jerk. I think if we did a Google search on the term boss is a jerk versus employee is a jerk, you will find 10 million examples of boss being described as jerk.
Yeah.
Is that a function of our radical egalitarianism that it is okay to ridicule power? But we cannot say that a worker bee is a jerk.
Yeah.
Is that an example of American compassionate work? Pardon the pun.
Well, okay, so 2 points here. One is that I think that there's some objective truth to the fact that people with power within a workplace do tend to be bigger jerks. However, I want to grant your point. I think that oftentimes people don't appreciate their bosses. And the John Templeton Foundation did a survey of 2,000 Americans that they published earlier this year. And they found that the person in the workplace who is least likely to ever be thanked is the boss.
Right. Now, you say bosses are more likely to be jerks. Now, if one steps away from orthodoxy and really thinks logically, it is not random that people who get promoted to be the boss, they're not usually stupider. They're not usually lazier. They're not usually Yes, there are the well-publicized examples of the boss who will stomp on everybody's feet to get ahead. But net-net, on average, I think it would be very tough to argue that the pool of human beings called boss is less worthy, more jerk-centric than the pool of worker bees. And is it not possible that to the extent that sometimes bosses are frustrated or act as, quote, jerks, it's because they are under more pressure, or their supervisees are simply dumber, lazier, less ethical, and so they've got to bang down on it, and yet the boss can't call them jerks.
Yeah.
That would be politically incorrect. So only the worker who doesn't want to take responsibility goes and says the boss is a jerk rather than owning responsibility. Is that a possible analysis?
Well, sure. What I was thinking about as you were talking was more research from my colleague, Dacher Keltner. He found that people who tended to achieve power within workplaces or in any environment tended to be more socially and emotionally intelligent as they were climbing the ladder.
Definitely.
So they were very smart about people's emotions, very smart about people's motivations. But here's the catch. when they achieve power, those skills tended to deteriorate. It's a paradox. It's what Dacher calls the power paradox.
Here's my attempt to explain the paradox. Most really competent people hate that social BS, all that political crap.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they realize it's like when you're an assistant professor and you're trying to get tenure, you really don't want to write all those stupid journal articles, but you realize that's the price one pays to get tenure and the holy grail of job security.
Not to mention kissing the butt of your committee chair or whatever.
Exactly right. Yeah. But then after they get tenure, their productivity goes down. Not because they decide to be lazy, but they didn't want to do that anyway, and they reallocate their effort to what they believe is more important. Same with the person who's hiring the climbing the ladder. So somebody who's a worker bee wants to become a poobah, and so he or she is going and, you know, kissing butt and doing all that political stuff and playing nicey, and that takes a lot of time and energy, especially if you're an introvert. And then you finally get to be the boss, and you say, I don't need to do all this crap anymore. Now I can just focus on creating the best, most productive goods and services I can for my nonprofit, for my company. So is it really more of an abuse of power or a wise reallocation of time that the boss then is not worried about being so nice anymore but trying to get the job done well?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think you raise an interesting point. It is stressful to try to be to constantly pay attention to other people's feelings. And yeah, I mean, you know, you need to reallocate those resources. You know, when I was coming here to the studio, I rode my bike here. You know, I took the BART and then I rode my bike and I was racing past people and I was forgetting to say on your left, on your right. And I could see them jump as I passed by. Now, why was I doing that? Why was I being such a jerk? Well, I was being a jerk because I was running a little late and I needed to get here. And, you know, and I was thinking about this conversation that we're having right now. And I was, you know, I had that little bit of stress and it made me much less, you know, likely to pay attention to other people.
That's a perfect way to transition into solutions. We've talked about the problem, the multivariate causalities of the problem, but I think we all can agree that the workplace would be better with a measure of kindness and or gratitude suffused through the workplace. But first, let's let our listeners know what we're doing here. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Jeremy Adam Smith. He is the web editor at the Center for the Berkeley, UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. And why don't you tell us the website? There's good stuff on that website. Why don't you give us the website so that people can go and check it out?
Well, of course, I'd recommend that you do a Google search for Greater Good Science Center, but the web address is greatergood.berkeley.edu.
Perfect. Okay, so let us turn to solutions. Let's say, instead of having to, you know, unfortunately, in most organizations, you need three signatures to blow your nose. But let's give you a little more fiat power for the fun of it. Let's say you were the president of UC Berkeley, or of Clorox Corporation, or of the federal government's Office of Health and Human Services, or whatever. So you're ahead of a huge organization. And you were to have to issue three edicts, none of this democracy, consensus, decision by consent, none of this crap. You're going to make three edicts. You're the czar. You're not the president, you're not the CEO, you're the emperor.
All right. So right away, we've undermined, you know, the very premise of what we're trying to do.
That's right. We're creating maximum power.
All right.
We realize that really most people, when they are, you know, they may have excesses. But if you look, I mean, can you really say that Barack Obama or even, heaven forbid, George W. Bush, all he wanted to do was abuse power? No. Most of what they do is well-intentioned. So, you know, I do think I'm a career counselor. Most of my clients are very senior people. And let me tell you, they are well-intentioned. They are not jerks. Now, I haven't met one jerk, not one.
Yeah.
They all want to do the right thing. Do they get stressed? Yes. But the point is, okay, so you're a reasonable, you're not a saint, you're a typical benevolent leader
person
of these enormous organizations. And you say, okay, one of my initiatives is going to be to try to increase kindness and compassion in my workplace without destroying productivity, maybe even enhancing productivity, as you implied earlier.
Yeah.
What would be your first one, two, or three edicts?
Well, first, I would make it part of my practice to be grateful, to be forgiving, to be empathic, to be compassionate in my conduct.
Before you go there, go further, you said you can't, off the air, that's when I introduced this segment, you said you just don't do a good job, it's really good to say you're doing it.
Okay, all right. So the first thing I would do is I would go to the people I work with and I would tell me when I'm being a jerk. Tell me when I can be more compassionate.
Tell me
when I can be more empathic. And then I would communicate that to all of the people I supervise who supervise other people.
I like it. Feedback loops are critical. Love it. Continue.
All right. Well, the second thing is I would create lots of opportunities, for example, for gratitude. At UC Berkeley, you know, one of our units has a page where people can go. It's a web page, and they can go and they can express gratitude to their colleagues.
Love
and
it.
That feeds into a wall and people can read it and they can
love
see it.
It
in public.
It can only help. That can't hurt. It is no cost, minimal time, purely voluntary, and can only help. I love these ideas. Keep going. I love it.
Well, you know, and I think the third thing I would do is I would make sure that the people who generally do thankless work get thanked.
Love it, too.
You know, the people who mop the floors, the people who write the copy, the people who... And it, this has two effects. One is, you know, it increases morale, it increases cohesion, and research shows that it increases trust. However, it also informs people about how the organization works. You're calling attention to different parts of the organization, and you're letting people know, you know, what's involved. You're creating bridges. You know, you were describing a sort of dystopian workplace earlier where people are sort of in their holes and they don't see what other people are doing. Well, you know, and that harms productivity. That harms workplace morale and cohesion. It hurts retention. This is a solution to that.
I think it's a fabulous solution. And, of course, that does tie into one of my core values. You know, those who had the luck to be either born smart or into some good families or who have good health and whatever, they end up getting positions of authority and power and whatever, and they get accolades, they get praise from family, from coworkers, they get money, they get all this other stuff. If somebody had the bad luck, and I really do, the older I get, the more I believe that luck matters. Yeah. They had the bad luck of being born into the wrong family with the wrong genes, meeting the wrong people, just could not do well in school, and now they are the mopper of the floor that you described. Mm. Much of that was really beyond their control. The previous show to this is called Philosophy Talk, and there's a great question about determinism versus free will that is endless. How much is determined? Well, to some extent, that person's life was very constrained from the moment they entered this earth. And yet that person, rather than choosing to be home and stay on the dole and have somebody else take care of them, is choosing to come in every day to mop the floor. Those are heroes for me. Yeah. Those are people who are more arguably worthy, because despite their having lost in the genetic and environmental lottery, they are still doing what the big poobah is doing. They're coming in every day and mopping the floor. Right. Those should be heroes, and that is a value that I think, if inculcated throughout the workplace, mm-hmm. as you said, would create a sense of loyalty, honor, and a sense of that the organization is doing the right thing by humanity. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Say a little more. Is there anything else you want to... This is so central to me. Say anything. I don't know specifically what to ask, so I'm going to just broad brush ask you. As the CEO of such a large organization, for-profit or non-profit, doesn't matter, what else would you do to enhance gratitude and compassion in them? And again, back to the fact that you yourself say you're crappy at it. What would you do to make yourself walk the talk?
You know, the trick for a lot of these things is to simply be mindful, to simply be aware, because oftentimes what happens is we forget. We get too caught up in the tasks immediately in front of us. We get too caught up in the goals that are in front of us. We get too caught up in our own stress, and we forget these things. And so simply being reminded, being asked to reflect upon it.
Listening to the show,
right. That's the point. That's why I appear on shows like this, is to remind people so that when you go into work on Monday, you can say to yourself, geez, I should thank people. You know, I should forgive people for these petty transgressions.
Take a post-it. Stick it on the side of your monitor frame. Yeah. A stupid little thing is like write the word gratitude, compassion. You won't do it all the time, but maybe it will keep it more top of mind.
Right. Yep. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, those small cues matter. They're easy to mock. It is very easy to make fun of every single thing that I'm saying, but it's also very easy to forget to say thank you. It's very easy to forget that other people have feelings. We're really, really good at that. We're extraordinarily good. That doesn't mean we're hypocrites. It means that we're human, that we're, you know, that we are subject to forces, psychological and biological forces beyond our control, and that to correct for them, it takes some conscious effort.
I mocked your causality, your explanations of causality and your colleagues' causality for the lack of
stress and
compassion.
I mock myself all the time.
Good. But I'm not mocking your solutions at all. I think they really make sense, and I do hope, dear listeners, that you have that we all would take heed to them. We have a few minutes more left, and I want to switch gears for the fun of it. You've done some writing about other topics as well, including the fact that in ever more households today, women are the primary breadwinner and men are not. What are the implications that you're seeing of that for women, for men, and for society?
Well, that is a huge question. You know, I think, first of all, to look at what we were just talking about and connect it back to that, you know, women ask for a lot more in terms of social and emotional intelligence in the workplace. And, you know, and that's been one of the effects of the infusion of women into the workplace, is that, you know, we're just... We as men are simply asked to pay a lot more attention to people's feelings. you know, and whether this is due to nature or nurture, that's not a question that I think we can engage with right now. But the fact remains that that is the way it is, and we have a lot of science that points to it.
Right.
And, you know, and personally, my point of view is that that's good for us as men. That it's giving us the capability to develop new skills, new aptitudes, to have healthier relationships, and I think we have only benefited.
As in almost all factors, it's a matter of degree. Some certainly, the absolute no-nonsense, you know, roll over whatever it is for more profit or whatever, even more societal benefit, probably it's wise for men to have a measure of increased emotional intelligence, and I think that's been one of the big pluses of the women's movement.
Yeah.
I have also seen it go too far, a lot. There have been workplaces that have been paralyzed, to use the word, into dysfunction through the endless focus on process, feelings, exploration. And the more a workplace fans the flames of people feeling aggrieved, feeling hurt, etc., it becomes an absolute, like, curare, paralytic, on a workplace getting anything done. I am a consultant to a number of corporations, and one of them is extremely process-oriented. It is all about decision-making by consensus, express your feelings, and they get nothing done. The stock price has tanked since there has been a number of years ago. There was a change in the leadership that emphasized that very thing. So it's a matter of balance, I think.
Well, I might surprise you by absolutely agreeing with you. I mean, I think it can go way too far. And the question is, you know, how do you cultivate these things without interfering with other functions? What under what conditions are they the most effective?
In
what circumstances are they the most effective?
I love it. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, I think it's very important to build a sense of trust first. To build a sense of people being on the same team.
How do you do that? You can take people on those outdoor adventures and kumbaya and team building and communication workshops, and they play the game in the workshop because their boss makes them, and then they go back and really, as you talked about the fact that we all have primal instinct for survival, it's the same reason that communes failed, because in the end, when it came time for taking care of number one, they took care of number one. Right. How do you establish trust in a world where it is a zero-sum game? Some of them people are going to get laid off. Others are going to get promoted.
Right.
How do you create trust in that environment? Sir?
Well, you know, first of all, it's incredibly difficult to create trust in an environment when there's layoffs, for example. It's incredibly difficult to create gratitude in a workplace where, you know, there are penalties to failure, right? But there's a couple things I think you can do. For example, you know, I think that after a time of crisis, and all workplaces go through some period of crisis, there's some layoffs, a major project fails, it can take lots of different forms. I think it's very important to gather people together in either units or their, you know, teams or the workplace as a whole if it's smaller, and take time for Thanksgiving and actually sit down and try to reframe this negative event in ways that you know, can actually help people to see it in a new way. So you can say, what lessons did this experience teach us? Can we find ways to be thankful for what happened to us now, even though we were not at the time that it happened? What ability and what experience did this event draw out of us that surprised us? You know, if we do this, this actually builds the resilience of the organization over the long term. You know, now, I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about this. I mean, sometimes, you know, workplaces go bad.
I'm trying to picture this.
Yeah.
Let's say I am a survivor of a layoff.
Yeah.
And
I've been a survivor of a layoff.
Right.
Twice.
And the boss calls me in and said, it's time for Thanksgiving. You're lucky you didn't get laid off. Yeah. Or, you know, that's going to make me feel, oh, geez, well, I'm waiting the next. I mean, it feels very phony. Am I wrong? How's that going to build trust?
If it genuinely is phony,
how could it not be phony? I mean, be grateful you weren't laid off. How is anybody going to feel greater trust among coworkers with a kumbaya thing like that?
Well, first of all, I think the boss, in order to be authentic, has to acknowledge that reality and that dynamic. Pretending as though everybody's going to be happy now is absolutely the wrong thing to do. It creates too much cognitive dissonance, creates too much anger and resentment. Right. People put on a mask. They're faking it. That's a terrible thing to do. The most important thing to do is to acknowledge the feelings that were created by this event.
Let me try some for the fun of it. I like the general concept, but somehow the notion of Thanksgiving is wrong. I don't know what I'm going to say, but I'm going to pretend I'm that boss. yep. and I've just presided over, let's say, I've just one-third of the jobs.
And
I'm
you
just,
feel bad because it sucks laying people off. So I've done that too.
Right. So I'm going to pretend that I just made a decision to send one-third of the jobs to India. Right.
Okay.
And now I'm.
You're evil, Marty.
Well, but that's what you're saying. Right.
Of course, those Indians needed the jobs. So,
that's right. You know, if we truly are world citizens, like the Center for the Greater Good, no doubt says, we should feel equal compassion for the person in Mumbai as we do for the person in Bakersfield.
Sure. So, I hope you're paying him enough in India.
Yeah. And with full, probably. Anyway. For in terms of Indian standard living, their standard of living is going up far more than an American getting a salary increase. They're thrilled.
They're
when
a developing nation. Yeah.
They are thrilled when an American company opens up shop there, because instead of living on $1 a day, they're living on $15 a day. When they are thrilled, those numbers are wrong, but the concept is true.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to pretend
you're the evil boss.
I'm the boss who says
we should get back to gender in a moment.
Okay, we will.
Let's say you're a woman. You're the evil woman boss.
I'm the evil woman boss.
Okay,
and I, because my boss wanted me, and also I care about the shareholders who have invested their life savings so they can have secure retirement or afford to send their kids to college. And I realized that it would be far wiser than paying people $70,000 a year plus full benefits when I can get equally qualified or maybe even more qualified workers, accountants, let's say the accounting department, I send it off to the Philippines or India. I can get equally good work done and therefore keep my business afloat and make and enable my products to be cheaper because my costs are lower and provide more value to shareholders. I've made a decision to move the accounting department to India. And now I've had to talk to the two-thirds of people whose jobs have not yet been sent to India. Here's what I would be inclined to say. I would say, I can't imagine what it must feel like to be in your shoes, to see one-third of your colleagues have their jobs taken away for economic reasons. Yeah, to enhance shareholder value so they can retire more safely and that we can stay in business and maybe reallocate money to wiser investments. That's all abstract and intellectual, and it does rationally make sense, which is why I did it. I mean, I felt it was unconscionable, immoral, net. I would probably have quit. I think it's on the merits defensible, but on the human basis, very difficult.
Yeah.
And I can only tell you, my dear workers, that I can't predict the future for any of us, but that as long as I'm your boss, I will try to treat each of you with as much humanity as I possibly can and hope that if you're feeling in some ways that I'm not doing that, that you'll call me on it, because you don't have to be a jerk in order to be efficient.
Marty, will you be my boss? That was very inspiring.
Okay. That would be the shot I would take at it, for what it's worth.
Yeah, well, here's my critique of your performance. I thought that was really great. I mean, you know, it acknowledged the human cost, but it also acknowledged that, you know, the economic benefits to the move. And, you know, the problem with being a leader or a manager is that you have to think of the health of the organization as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that means making very hard decisions sometimes. And the important thing is to acknowledge the human cost to those very hard decisions. I mean, it's just like ending a marriage in some ways. Sometimes marriages have to end.
That's right.
You know, you don't have to be a jerk about it. It's hard. It's very, very hard. And I'm sure a lot of listeners have been in that situation of ending a relationship. In fact, we probably all have. And, you know, and that person may hate your guts. One of the things I've learned as I've gotten older, you were talking about you're getting older. I'm, you know, I recently turned 42, is that life goes on. And I think that that's very important to keep in mind, both as an employee and also as a supervisor. You know, when I had to lay people off, I felt like the worst, most evil person in the world. I laid them off because we didn't have the money to pay them anymore, right? One of the things I discovered is that life goes on. Both the people that I had to lay off went on to bigger and better things, and we're still friends. You know, we're still friends through Facebook. We talk all the time. I even go to them for career advice sometimes. You know, so that's very important. Life goes on.
We're just about out of time. I wanted to go back, as you asked, to go back to the women's issue. So tell us an implication or two. I know you said we could spend hours on it. But the implication or an implication or two of the rather dramatic change that's occurred in the last 10 years, where now many more women, maybe I think even the, I'm not sure, many more women certainly are the primary breadwinner in a male-female household. Yeah. What are some of the perhaps surprising implications of that for women, for men, and society?
Well, we talked about one, which is that a lot more is being asked of men, which actually creates stress, which I think we should all acknowledge.
True.
A lot of men have trouble, just as women do, in juggling home and family and also juggling emotional demands with these economic demands. The need to be a breadwinner hasn't gone away.
Right.
However, you know, there's and that's a downside, right? That stress. But there's a good side, too, for families, which is that families have become more economically resilient. They have. You know, when you have two incomes, you are more resilient than if you just have one income.
Sure.
You know, that's why the Great Depression could be so incredibly destructive. You know, now you have situations where many women are perfectly capable of supporting families if the man loses his job. And that demands a fundamentally different sort of understanding of what an ideal worker is. An ideal worker is not somebody who can live in the office. An ideal worker is somebody who also has some home responsibilities, and we should acknowledge that. And I think a lot of the best workplaces have acknowledged that. At the same time, you know, for men, you know, we can't just assume that we're going to, you know, I was raised to be a breadwinner, to one day support a family, and I have done that for a long time. But there's other things that I need to do. I need to pick up my socks. I need to do the dishes. I need to know all of the things I need to know about how to take care of my son and deal with his schooling and all of that stuff. And I'm living in a much more and working in a much more complex environment than my father did. And it is more stressful, but I believe that our families are gaining a lot.
I agree with much of what you said, but not all. You said the ideal worker. Hmm. I am, at the risk of sounding politically correct, a bigger fan of diversity. There is no ideal worker. I have seen people who live the life well led by living lives that are utterly out of balance, who do not pick up their socks, who do not do anything, and they spend all of their life, whether it 90 hours a week. We talked off the air about, you know, all of the people who we are so great. You were looking at your smartphone. The people who created the smartphone probably lives had out of balance and were not picking up their socks and spending a lot of time with their kid on their homework.
They're probably paying people to pick up their socks.
Yeah, could be. But even if someone is poor, I like to use the example of somebody who is a clerk, who in hours 40 to 60 of the work week choose to make sure that all of the bills are paid, that the people who are, she's an accounts payable clerk, gets all the bills out promptly and on time, and that makes more money for her because she's getting overtime because she is not an exempt worker, and she, I think, provides a fine role model for her kids as long as she provides quality time. I don't think that such people should be denigrated as workaholic. You say there is the right kind of person. I really think that the complexity you extol, and I extol as well, it should be one of that there are many approaches to the life well led, from the extreme workaholic to somebody who just does the minimum in order to support him or herself on the planet. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would, actually. You know, I think that human beings are so diverse, and there is so much diversity in the workplace, and we're not just talking here about racial or cultural diversity. I mean, there's diversity of personalities, and we're becoming very sophisticated.
And work ethic, the meaning of life is for people.
That's right. And people bring different motivations to work. You know, one of the great things about gratitude, to go back to that, is that gratitude is a non-monetary way to recognize the non-monetary motivations that we bring to work. I don't want to discount monetary motivations. Those are very important. You want to pay people enough so that they can live. You want them to be happy. And, you know, we all go through times in our lives where money is very important. And sometimes that's going to be the primary motivation. But there's going to be other times where it's not. And those are the times when acknowledging somebody's contributions becomes very important, but also acknowledging the different motivations that we bring to work.
And I want to acknowledge the contribution you've made to work with Marty Nemko.
All right.
Jeremy Adam Smith was my guest. He is the web editor for the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. I invite you to Google it, and you will indeed find many of his and his colleagues' articles, which I do think you will find edifying. Again, thanks again.
Thank you.
Take care. And now we turn to you, my dear listeners. If you or someone you love has got a career-related problem, I do something called 3-minute workovers. And I promise I won't pummel you, but I will try to help you whether you're 16 or 76, whether you're career clueless or just simply need a career tweak, self-employed, employed by a company, nonprofit, or government agency. The commonality of my request to you is that you are stuck. If you are stuck in any aspect of your work life, I invite you to call for that 3-minute workover. Over the phone number, 415-841-4134. What is that the number for? Work with Marty Nemko here on KALW, 415-841-4134. In the last 2 weeks, I actually summarized a a talk that I gave at UC Berkeley a week or 2 weeks ago called Eight Career Truths That May Not Be So True. And I got through seven of them the last 2 weeks, but one has remained undiscussed. And I feel it would be worth your time to hear me discuss this, although I have at times mentioned this before. One of the ostensible career truths is that getting a degree is usually a wise bet. I mean, you would think that I'd be a strong advocate for getting degrees. After all, my parents constantly told me that education is the answer. And indeed, I have a PhD from right here at Berkeley, and in the field of educational psychology. And indeed, I did. I used to believe that getting degrees usually is a wise choice, not just for career preparation, but for enlightenment. But over the past decades, I have become less sure. The first sense I got of being less sure was when I was in graduate school at Berkeley, and when I was forced to take so many courses that I knew would contribute very little to my being a good professional or even a good citizen and good human being. What comes to mind is Professor Leonard Marasciullo. He was a statistics professor. He was able somehow to convince the administration that every education doctoral student needed five-unit graduate-level statistics courses. I mean, the reality is that many, if not most, PhDs hire a statistical consultant or use a statistical consultant to do their statistics. Were those five-unit graduate-level courses in statistics really the best use of students' time and money? That started to make me question higher ed's value. And then when I became a consultant to colleges, in the private conversations behind those ivy-covered walls, behind all the rhetoric in colleges' brochures and their PR departments about caring about students and wanting to help them grow, I found that too many administrators seem to care more about bringing in research dollars, hiring more research-centric professors, even if they couldn't teach worth a damn. They cared about their U.S. news rankings. Yep. They cared about increasing alumni donations a lot. And they cared about protecting their own careers. When they talked about undergraduate education, it was mainly about increasing retention while lowering the cost of students to the university, but never about lowering the price that students were paying. And more recently, I have read, and this I did mention on this show, but it's important to mention in this context, that there have been really good studies about how much or how little learning occurs in undergraduate education. The definitive study was called Academically Adrift. It was published by University of Chicago Press. And they found that 36% of college graduates nationwide grew not at all in critical thinking or writing. And regarding the achievement gap that worries so many of us, worries the nation certainly, the students who did poorly in high school were on average the least likely to grow, the most likely to have grown zero or very little. Certainly way too little to justify the opportunity cost of all that money and time of going to college. Now, of course, many people attend college not just to improve their writing and critical thinking skills, but their employability. And in decades past, as colleges are more than happy to trumpet, going to college did increase your employability. But recently, over the last decades, as we sent ever more students to college, we now sent 72% of kids to college. We have an oversupply. So an Associated Press analysis of data from 2011 found that 54% of college graduates under 25 were unemployed, or if they were lucky enough to get employed, underemployed. That means they were working in jobs they could have gotten out of high school, no college. And that, of course, is especially likely in fields that don't particularly impress employers like sociology or American studies or art history. And that really does remind me of a particular client. I'll call him Joe. He was the first in his family to go to college. And his family was so proud he got. He didn't go to Berkeley. He went to UC San Diego. And even more proud, he graduated. And he graduated with a 3.6 GPA. Majored in psychology. What's the best job he's been able to find so far? Working at an electronics retailer, famous one. I won't mention the name. Where his job includes such tasks as finding someone to unclog the toilets. And even science and technology majors have, according to a 2012 Georgetown University study, science and technology majors, this shocked me, have an unemployment rate higher than the overall average. The national average is 7.6. Listen to this. Major in overall science majors, the unemployment rate is 8.2%, bachelor's degree. Mechanical engineering, 8.6%. Information systems, this shocked me, 11.7%, higher than the national average. Okay, maybe undergraduate education, since everybody goes to college now, maybe graduate school is the answer. Well, in April this year, 2000, The Atlantic reported, quote, 9 months after graduation, just 56% of the law school class of 2012 had found stable jobs in law, end quote. That means 44% had not. Now, I looked around for the national averages for the supposedly most marketable degree, the MBA. But according to a November 2012 Bloomberg Businessweek report, 10% of MBA graduates from Cal, from Berkeley, were unemployed 3 months after graduation, and 23% of MBAs from USC were unemployed. I can only imagine the unemployment rate of graduates who went to less prestigious MBA programs like USF or San Francisco State. But what about the PhD? National Science Foundation report, and this one shocked me more than any of the rest. Fewer than 40% of new PhDs had a job waiting for them at graduation. Another 35% had signed up for a postdoc. That means more studying. And 28% of PhDs, new PhDs, had nothing. Now, I am not saying don't get a degree. I mean, after all, we could flip the statistics around. It's how you report it. You know, 90% of those UC Berkeley MBAs were employed. I'm guessing most of them well employed. I'm merely asking you to not just reflexively follow the conventional wisdom. Degree, good. Decide whether for you, going back for a degree is wiser than, for example, learning at what I call UU. Working at the elbow of a successful ethical master. Reading, attending short courses like those offered through your professional association. And if you're going to get a degree, I invite you to not give disproportionate weight to the so-called practicality of a STEM major, science, technology, engineering, and math. Not only, as I mentioned, are today's unemployment rates, even in those STEM fields, surprisingly high. If those fields don't play to your strengths, you're particularly likely to not graduate or to graduate without skills that are sufficient to succeed in those fields. You might be wiser to major in something that on the face of it seems less practical, like rhetoric. Berkeley has a very eminent rhetoric major, which more than most fields teaches you generalizable skills, the skill of persuasion, the skill of logical reasoning. Those are crucial to almost any career. Ironically, that may make you more endurably employable than if you pursued an expressly careerist degree. Okay. I want to stress again that I'm not against getting degrees. I just want you to evaluate the decision to spend the time and money carefully. Richard Bowles, the author of What Colors Your Parachute, says that many people choose their vacation more carefully than they choose their career. I merely invite you to as carefully consider whether you should go back to school as how you should spend your vacation. Okay, now, I'll give out the phone number one more time, and then we're going to go right to the phones. If you have a problem or a work-related problem, I invite you to call in for what I call a three-minute workover. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now, to the phones, thank you for your patience. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, my name is Stephanie, and as I'm listening to you, I feel familiar with what you were talking about. I'm the first one in my family to go to college. I started as an ESL student. It took me about 12 years to get my undergrad. I went to San Jose State. I originally was doing nursing, and then I switched into public health because I did not want to be a nurse, and now I'm unemployed since last year. I was working in San Francisco for a nonprofit, but I felt very disappointed with the environment. They were doing good work, but at the expense of the employees. And I just feel very turned off by the people that are there. There's a lot of competition, and then when you go and you apply to jobs in a lot of places, I feel like they exploit people, and it's not a good working environment. So I've been kind of discouraged, and I was not looking for a while, but I'm trying to get back in, but I'm not sure, like, how to approach it. I have work experience because while I was going to get my education, I was also working. And I did that for a while, but then I ended up quitting my job so that I could focus on nursing. And then in 2008, when the economy almost collapsed, I was thinking about quitting school and go back to work, but then I couldn't at that point.
Okay, let me interrupt you. Before we, we're going to try to come up with a good solution for you, but a lot of listeners are surprised, you know, and I've said this unfortunately on the radio before, but that unfortunately nonprofits, because so many people are applying for the job, you would think that nonprofits with their value of ostensibly caring about people would treat their workers well, but they treat them terribly. What was your experience? How do you feel they treat that? You use the term exploited. How did the nonprofits exploit you or exploit workers?
They wanted people to do the work of three. I felt they wanted me to do the work of three people. They hired me for one position, but they also wanted me to do the job of essentially two other people. I lost track of how many people left the company when I was there, and I was there less than a year. They had a very high turnover rate, and it just seemed that there was not a lot of accountability because they were getting funding from the city, from the state, but as opposed to a for-profit where you have, I guess, a board of directors or shareholders. But for the nonprofit, I felt that the accountability wasn't there, and the people running the company, I felt they looked at new employees with a suspicious eye based on, I don't know if they had previous experience with other people who didn't perform or whatever, but from the day one, I felt that we were looked that way. And I had worked in high tech before, and we were not treated like that. There was an element of trust and an assumption that you want to be there. And I worked in R&D. I was an administrative assistant with an organization, a big company that spun off from Hewlett Packard. And so I worked with scientists and engineers, but I was also going to school. And there was really no room for me to go into anything else without the proper education, but I was working on it, but I couldn't advance quickly because I was working full time.
Okay, let's go to solutions. So you found yourself happiest working in the high tech world, and the two nuggets so far that implies potential career directions, of course, are if you're happy in the high tech world, should you be trying to find the right job for you in the high tech world? And second, nursing. The Bay Area, unfortunately, is saturated for almost any jobs in nursing except for critical care, intensive nursing, and home visiting nursing. Do you want to either get back into the high-tech world or find a job in a niche within nursing that is not impacted, whether it be home visiting nurses or hospice nurses, and I don't know about hospice nurses, I just made that up, intensive care nursing?
No, but I'm not a nurse. I switched into public health.
So I see.
I didn't graduate as a nurse. I graduated with a degree in public health.
Okay, so let's go back. You were happiest working in high tech. Would it, given that you have some public health background, as a way of, it sounds like you've been unemployed a while, is that correct? That maybe the way to get back in the workplace is to find a job in a biotech organization, because it'll give you the culture that is indeed more efficiency oriented and does tend to, I do think that in general, maybe because they have more money or whatever, they do treat people better. And you could then use the fact that you have a public health degree just to explain that at least you understand some more of the issues. What feels right and wrong about your trying to get a job for now as an admin in a biotech company using your both administrative experience and public health training as arguments for why they should hire you?
Well, I've applied to various companies as an admin, but I just haven't landed an offer. And a lot of times they respond like 6 months later, or sometimes they don't respond at all. Or sometimes I do get an interview, but they end up hiring someone with more experience, maybe with an advanced degree. So far I haven't landed an opportunity.
How many interviews have you had?
I've had 4 interviews.
Okay. If you're 0 for 4, it's a it means that they're not necessarily looking for the graduate degree. It implies that either your interview wasn't impressive enough, or your interview was impressive enough, but they then contacted your references and your references weren't as strong as you'd hoped they'd be. Do you think it was either that your interviewing skills weren't that great, or that your references may have turned out to not be supportive?
Well, what happened is the company that I worked for like 6 years, at Agilent Technologies,
right.
And they have this policy against giving references.
Okay, so let's forget the references. Let's talk about the interview. You know, in unfortunately, it is true that despite what the public statistics say, it is really hard to get a job. There are many, many applicants for most jobs. Down in, you know, in the real trenches, you ask anybody who's applying for a job, there isn't like one or two people applying. There's usually, for most jobs, it's 10, 20, 100. So it's really hard. Is it possible that your interview, while maybe adequate, was not enough to make you top of the heap?
I think I interviewed pretty well. I think it was more on the references the thing was, the person that I worked for before said that he can't give me references because it's against company policy. So the person that I worked for the longest can't give me a reference because he'll get in trouble.
I understand that is official company policy, but having been a consultant to many companies and individuals, that rule can be very much bent. I'll give you my favorite way of showing how it can be bent is this. Let's say a company has a policy of not giving references. But let's say you worked for me and I thought you were terrific. And if somebody then called and asked for a reference about you, I would say, oh, I'm so sorry. The company has a policy for not giving references. Oh, yeah, but she worked here and she left voluntarily. That's one way. I can say those exact same words and say, I thought you were a terrible employee. I would say, yes, the company has an official policy of not giving references. She did work here. She left voluntarily. You can see just in my, without changing words at all, I can create a completely different impression. So is it possible that your references, even if they're not giving a reference, are subtly conveying that you're not that good?
I don't know. I had a great relationship with the person I worked with, and he originally wrote this terrific letter.
Good.
And he told me, don't use it because they talked to us and they said we can't give references. So I stopped using his name. And now I looked for my boss's boss, and he's willing to give me a reference. So I just got that connection.
So that may be, there's two things I'm going to leave you with. Number one is, if you have, you know, somebody who you think might not have given you a great reference, maybe go back, you know, and it may not be, you know, very often employers don't just go to the references you give. Especially if you're giving somebody who's other than your boss, they will go back and talk to your boss because they have figured if you didn't list your boss as a reference, that there's perhaps a problem, but that the boss is in the best position to know how you are. So I would be contacting my previous bosses who you maybe didn't list, who were, you know, not every boss, but a relatively recent one, and chat with them and talk about, get a sense of whether you think they would provide a reasonable reference, or at least allow you to, quote from your previous performance reviews or something, so that you will seem better if you're worried about your references. If it's your interviewing you're worried about, I would encourage you to video, you know, using your webcam on your computer or whatever, do a mock interview with somebody you trust, a friend who's smart and honest, and ask them for feedback on your interviewing. And then third, unfortunately, in this tight job market, a large percentage of jobs go to people who know somebody. So I would encourage you, if you like the idea of working in biotech as an admin, to get involved with various organizations where biotech workers go, whether it be Bay Area Bioscience brown bag lunches or simply a cafe or bar that people in right around Genentech or Amgen or Bayer. You know, the area around Emeryville, for example, is loaded with biotech companies, and there are cafes right near there. Hang out there. You may well meet people who work for those companies and get access. Those are my suggestions. Do you think those might help at all?
Well, I appreciate all of that, but the thing is, I don't want to do admin work. I went to school because I wanted to get out of that line of work, and I feel really disappointed with the idea of doing admin work.
Fair enough.
I don't want to do that.
Do you have a degree in public health? Did you finish your degree in public health?
Yes, I did.
Great. Bachelor's?
Bachelor's, yes.
Okay. So I would encourage you to do then is I'd encourage you to go to go to simplyhire.com and indeed.com and look for, I would encourage you to go to LinkedIn and look for, search on the term bachelor's degree in public health and see people who were hired with that degree, that will give you an idea as to which organizations are hiring. Obviously, places like UCSF and UC Berkeley and various nonprofits and government agencies, and I imagine even some of the biotech companies do hire people with a public health background. But finding the names of the companies and then trying to answer ads for those specific companies, but also using the techniques I outlined, that is the doing some videotaping of your interviews to find out how you're doing, going and checking to see if your reference is as good as they should be. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you.
Okay. We have time for one quick call, so let us go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hello, this is Leanne.
Hello, Leanne.
And you had me at Are You Stuck? I think a lot of people are feeling that, those of us that are in jobs.
You bet.
I've been in the same position for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I do have 20 years experience generally in the area where I work.
What's the area you work?
I'm in the utility business, but also kind of sales, account services.
Okay.
And it does feel like jobs are going to a lot younger folks.
Yep.
With less experience.
No question.
And maybe there's some fiefdoms, you know, where folks are comfortable just with a certain group of people, and it's hard to break into that group.
Absolutely. There, you know, we say we celebrate diversity, but indeed the phrase birds of a feather flock together has some truth. You judge, instead of judging, you know, based on people's rhetoric, I remember it wasn't long ago, maybe 10 years ago, PBS went to Berkeley High School, which is considered the school that most celebrates diversity. And they went into the cafeteria, which is the one time during the day where kids can sit where they want. And it was absolutely fiefdoms. They were completely divided by race. There was even an area on the ground called Little Africa, Little Asia, Little East. They all had separated. So, yes, there are fiefdoms that get created, unfortunately. Despite our protestations of wanting to celebrate diversity, people tend to be exclusionary.
Yeah, I experienced that, and I know I've put together a diverse team, so I'm really proud of that. I try to take on extra projects and work with different groups in different parts of the company.
So tell me how you're stuck.
Promotional-wise.
I see. Okay.
It's not happening, and I've gone on some interviews within the firm. But it seems like the person that gets hired is somebody they had in mind
right from
the beginning.
So given the limited time, I'm going to just leave you with one or maybe two quick tips. Number one, you may have already done this, but clearly the most obvious thing is to go to your boss and say, I'm eager to get promoted to blah. Is that realistic? And if so, what do I need to do step by step to get here from here to there? Have you done that?
Yes, I think.
Okay.
I have.
Have you tried to volunteer to work for a powerful and influential person who is other than your boss to take when they need an extra pair of hands so that they can see your work and see that you're worth promoting?
No, I haven't done that.
Well, I will quit then while I'm ahead, and I'm looking at the clock, and that is all the time we have for Work with Marty Nemko, so I will thank you for the call. And I will also thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers. And you or someone you love is graduated and is back living at home, not doing much to land a job. How much help should family give? Job leads? Write his resume for him? Kick him out? Should she take any job or only a launchpad job? What if she's clueless on what she's launching toward? My wife, Barbara Nemko, and I are going to kick around solutions for new grads. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.